It may not seem so, but I can sincerely thank the organizers for the invitation, especially since I should say that I had to be really convinced to give this talk. This talk partly reflects some longstanding concerns and interests in the philosophy of science. And the first part of the talk, that is topics 1, 2, and 3, are a admittedly, non-specialist, that is, I'm not specialized as a professional philosopher of science or historian, but it's an attempt to answer the demarcation problem raised by Popper and others as to, is there anything which demarcates science from other activity? And Steve Fuller, towards the end of his remarks, emphasized some issues about this problem, and I will explain what I understand the issues are and make a proposal. I'm very aware that this proposal may seem to experts, of whom there are a few here, naive, and I'm prepared to stand on my naivete to some extent, but I'm also very interested to see if nonetheless what the comments are. The next part, part 4, is an attempt to use the characterization of science that I present as a framework for talking about some large issues in the organization of science. And I have a conjecture which is related in part to demographics, so it's very nice to follow David, because some of the same demographics, or the extension of those demographics, that I think is at play. And one of the questions I've tried to ask myself, listening to the talks and to talks at similar meetings, is, what is all the stuff about the, not that I don't use the internet like everybody else, but what is all the stuff about science 2.0 and revolutionizing the way we collaborate and do science? Is there anything to do with it? And I'm aware of a feeling of being a kind of contrarian, and also very painfully of being, a member of an older generation who may not get it. So I have a hypothesis about that I will present and probably be told, yes, you don't get it, but we'll see. And then that will go into the last part, which is whether these proposals or ambitions about science 2.0 do help or do hinder, or dangers about which they may hinder our doing of science. And I will say some obvious positive things. I will briefly raise some concerns, although at the advice of Sabina, I've cut out most of that so as to be able to finish the talk with some more positive fantasies. Okay. Since we're talking about the organization of science and new directions and new adventures in the organization of science and new endeavors, I think I just want to remind everybody that we are in one. And this is our second Christmas picture at Perimeter Institute. And so that's roughly 5 years ago. And Perimeter Institute was very self-consciously intended as an experiment in the organization of science, intended to address many of the issues that are raised here. And I think it's fair at some point to say that we have done so in some cases, and in other cases have fallen woefully short of our ideals and hopes. And but we are an experiment, and we are meant to be critiqued as such. Hopefully, maybe some things copied and other things forgotten. Okay. Now, how does science work? So this is a cartoon one slide course in the philosophy of science, of a kind of which I myself have given, and some people in this room have given. There used to be a belief that there was a clear demarcation between science and other activities. For example, in the early part of the 20th century, the logical positivist introduced the notion that the meaning of a sentence is the procedure by which you would go about verifying whether it was true or false, and science consisted of the sum of knowledge that was so verifiable, and everything else was of no concern. That was critiqued and criticized and found to be very wanting. And the bulk of this course, of course, is why all these ideas failed. So I'm not, I don't have time to go into it. Somewhat later, Karl Popper proposed that even though, so part of the problem is that it's impossible to give a simple procedure for verifying the truth of the statements made in that result from scientific theories. Popper proposed that nonetheless, there is a sense in which there's an asymmetry, nonetheless, there's a sense in which not theories as a whole, but predictions of theories can be disconfirmed and therefore subject the theory as a whole to falsification. This is a very interesting and useful notion, but long since bit the dust. Indeed, we had a meeting last week on the landscape and its ramifications where this was heavily discussed, and the philosophers there were very careful to tell us that the language that they use now is confirmation and disconfirmation rather than verification and falsification. We can get in later to the subtle differences in those, and that in particular the claim of an asymmetry has not stood. Kuhn then followed that by some years and didn't directly address the demarcation problem, but proposed a way of thinking about the progress of science in a book called, and I think the title must have been carefully chosen, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which implies that there is a single structure that scientific revolutions go under, and that science proceeds of episodes of, quote, normal science, where we all follow well-defined research programs with well-set-out experimental and theoretical procedures, which then are subject to anomalies, which then cause a revolution, and then there's a revolutionary period, which is very finely demarcated, and then we're back to normal science again. And that sounded very good when I was an undergraduate student, and that book was required reading in every course I took in every subject. But by the time I got to graduate school, it was very clear that you just had to ask the question of, are we, you know, here in the late 70s in a normal period or a revolutionary period, and the whole thing fell apart. Feyerabend, that is the clear structure that Kuhn was looking for, is not to be found on close examination. Feyerabend then, in a book that influenced me greatly, Against Method, argued that there is no method of science, that scientists are opportunists, that we do whatever we can get away with to advance whatever our agenda happens to be. That whatever rule you think or methodology or advice you think is important for the progress of science, however you define the progress of science, is not his business. He will show you, one, it's logically necessary that that rule is violated sometimes, and B, that there are important historical episodes where it happened. And that's where the subject was when I was a graduate student, and I've been puzzling over it ever since. And it's not to imply that the professionals have not made progress on the problems, but the following are the result of some years of thinking about it myself. So how does science really work? Okay, and the several things struck me as input to the demarcation that I'm going to propose. One of them has been mentioned before, is that it's not that there are normal periods and then revolutionary periods and then normal periods and revolutionary periods. Most good scientists, you can't say anything which is true about all good scientists, but most good scientists are split. Most people working in science have partially a rebellious personality where we seek to make revolutions in our understanding, and most of us are also deeply conservative and have been trained very strictly in traditions which we very strongly respect, and the reasoning within which we pay much more attention to than reasoning outside of the tradition we were trained in. And the other thing that struck me is that there is an analogy between the processes by which science works, real scientists work, and the processes by which decisions are made in democratic societies. And what I have in mind is both judicial decisions, that is how judges and juries reach decisions, and how citizens reach decisions in elections. And in both cases, the burden is to reason from shared evidence, but always incomplete evidence, to limited conclusions, where, however, there is a sphere of conclusions that become consensus, which is ever expanding. So that's, those are the starting points, and how can this work? Okay. So my proposal, and this mirrors some things that were said before, I think it mirrors, I've also been told, work of the sociologist Merton, is that it's not an accident, it's a necessary feature of science that scientists work in communities. And those communities embody traditions of knowledge as well as technical tools and skills. And I choose to characterize those communities as being constituted by shared ethics. That is what defines and binds these communities and governs them ultimately are some ethical principles, which I'll be stating shortly. Here are some of the aspects of the things that we agree about and that are essentially ethical points. We agree to argue with each other in good faith, and in good faith is a very important line. That is, we are really interested in reaching an answer that we agree with each other about, from shared evidence to shared conclusions. And we work very hard at that, and we learn ways to structure those arguments. We are required to honestly report the results of what we do, our experiments, our observations, our calculations, to report them honestly. And a lot of stock is put on the expectation that we report honestly to each other, because most of us can only do a small portion of the experiments and calculations that underlie our knowledge. Human beings are incredibly error-prone. Human beings easily, because our main characteristic resulting, you know, responsible for our success as a species, is that we can act quickly and make quick decisions in the face of incomplete and rapidly changing evidence. We're very error-prone. We have a high error rate. And we fool each other, which is why lying is so frowned upon. We easily fool each other. And we easily fool ourselves. And because of that, those of us who really want to know the truth, referring, you know, to Steve Fuller's question, have to discipline ourselves in how to recognize error. And so what we learn when we are apprenticed into a scientific community is a whole bunch of techniques and tools and methods whose primary function is to identify and root out error in our own work. Okay. And these are communities that open up their membership to anybody, but to anybody who has mastered the craft up as it is in their field up to that point in detecting and recognizing and reporting errors. Okay. So that's a sort of rough pass, an attempt to state cleanly what the ethical principles are, is this. So I claim there are two. And one is that if an issue can be decided by people of good faith, again, you can always sabotage an attempt to find agreement, but being of good faith means you agree to have your mind changed by rational argument. Okay? Applying rational argument to publicly available evidence, then it must be regarded as so decided. I may not have liked inflation, but I have to agree that the case for inflation from the experimental data is strong, okay? Even if I sometimes will play with alternatives. Okay. That's the first principle. If, on the other hand, there is an issue or a question that rational argument from public evidence is not sufficient to decide or to bring people of good faith to agreement, then the community must allow and even encourage disagreement. And these two things, which embody the discipline and the respect of the scientific tradition on the one hand, the other hand, the continual desire to go beyond what we know, in balance define the ethics of what makes the scientific community work. That's my major claim, and that both are equally important. Okay. From this follows how you become a scientist, and I referred to this earlier, but this is a community defined by and governed by one adherence and allegiance to ethical principles, which doesn't mean we don't push the boundaries when we can, but that doesn't mean that ethics is not important. The fact that many of us will try on our best judgment to cut corners. And before that, to become accredited as a scientist, you have to demonstrate mastery over the tools of your trade and the techniques of your field sufficient to convince experts in the field that you can produce reliable results. You have to be able to write a paper and give a talk that reports the results of your work that is convincing to people who know the techniques that you're using and the history of the subject. Okay, so these principles, now I'm not going to say everything on the screen because this I've probably written too much, but these principles mold how we interact with each other. And again, there's always this dichotomy. We agree that each of us is free to make the case we want to make for the views that we have about the data, about the theories we believe or don't believe. There's a lot of freedom in being a scientist. One can choose to defend different points of view. One can choose to gather evidence. One can choose to examine different points of view. And one is free and encouraged to make the best case one can for one's point of view. There's a kind of advocacy, which is part of being a scientist. But one also understands that no matter how smart you think you are or how good of a case you think you've made, the real judges for the usefulness, the interest, or the truth of what you've done is the community, and even worse, the community of the students of your students. And what they will say is important. Okay, so from this, there are some conclusions that I think are inescapable, and I mention them because I think they're important for this whole, for these whole discussions about blogs and wikis and so forth, which we've been referring to so much here. One of them is that accreditation is necessary. A PhD is meaningful. This is not to say that people cannot contribute something to the progress of science without a PhD. But like many people, you know, who are a little bit in the public sphere, I get daily attempts to do science by people who are not professionally trained. And in 30 years of reading those emails and letters and books which were sent to me, I have not found one that was interesting from somebody who was not either a PhD student or had a PhD. And I'm a fair, open-minded person, and I have, you know, until a certain point when I stopped, I've read many, many of those things. Okay. Accreditation is necessary. There are lots of cases where amateurs can participate. Okay. But the role of standing in your community and saying, I have done a calculation or I have done an experiment and these are the conclusions and you should trust me, okay, that role, not for nothing, is given accreditation. With exceptions, and it says this, Freeman Dyson had no PhD because it was wartime, Charles Darwin, okay, et cetera. Yeah.
So I don't discount your experience of people writing to you at all, but if I, you know, judge sort of, you know, average level conversation, for example, by the conversations I have with people who accost me on the street, I would assume that, you know, most people are not capable of telling me much interest. Don't you think that's the sort of situation you're in? You're in the situation of people who are accosting me on the street.
I'm not saying that somebody can't make a certain kind of contribution. I'm not saying that I can't go to a party with some good artist and be told something about my field, which I've never thought about before, that I have to go and think about for a week. Okay, but I'm saying something different. So one more, and then I'm going to steer it because I have a lot. This is just the beginning. But go ahead.
I take it, Lee, that you're talking about your own field. You started here talking about science, but you know you can't say this stuff about science. there's so many different ways of doing science. So if you're talking about your own field, who are we to say
fair.
No? If you're talking about science, it's
fair. Fair point. Let me go on. Okay. A second thing, which is a key thing, and again, I used to think that this was a bother and a problem and a lack of objectivity in science, but I think it's essential for the working of science, is that we have reputations. Okay. And the community, that is the close community, okay, and you talked about different circles of community, so there's the close community of the people in your little research sub-area, there's a larger community, you can have different reputations in those different circles, but nonetheless, scientists have attached to their names reputations, which are determined largely by the importance and the interest of the papers they put their names on. And I think that is a way in which the community organizes itself because it's based on adherence to and allegiance to these ethical principles. That is the fact that when I post something on the archive, that it, you know, there's a reason that you said it can't be taken away. I've never tried to take something away, but there's a reason why you said that, which is that you should be afraid before you post something because your reputation is at stake because it will appear there with your name on it. And it joins the list of other things that have your name on it. And that's an essential way that the community disciplines and governs itself. Okay. And now, of course, like everything else, the reputations are subject to the two principles. That is, the few who have been fortunate enough to do things that become consensus, that pass from, so part of this view is that there's a body of knowledge about which there is consensus at any one time, which doesn't mean it can't sometimes, in rare cases, shift, but there is such a body. And then there is the larger body of proposed theories, new kinds of observations, techniques, or so forth, which are in contention. And we the two principles govern how we deal with those two very different aspects of science because they're both essential to us. And the same is true about reputation. People who have done something which passed over from conjecture to consensus have weighty reputations because of that, whether we happen to, you know, like other things they say or agree with them or like them personally. Nonetheless, we all agree that certain people are very significant scientists in a period. And other people and other aspects of our behavior, there's disagreement about, which is great. Okay. But nonetheless, reputation plays a key role. And this is why I was asking about track record. Reputation also plays a role in who you believe and who you pay attention to with all kinds of advice from, you know, which students to take, who to hire, what grants to fund, and so forth. Okay. And resulting from that is that authorship is a key thing. And this is where I know I'm stepping on some views and some ideas, and we can come to this in the discussion period. But my view is that the only way you can participate with, there are lots of things to do about science, but once you're in the scientific community, or I should say in a scientific community, you have a name and everything you do should be labeled with that name because you should do anything, whether it praise another's work, criticize another work, put forward your own ideas, et cetera, at stake to your reputation. Okay. So in my view, and I know this is controversial in this community, anonymous contributions and criticisms, not by lay people. Lay people can do what they like. They have no reputations to defend. But by scientists. No, I mean that. Okay, if I want to go and comment about, you know, the Venice Biennale, in which I think are the great upcoming artists at the Venice Biennale, nobody cares, right? If I comment on what I think are the, you know, most important five papers in my field in the last 2 years, people care. Okay, so I think I've said most of this. So let me highlight the conclusions and then from some more conclusions from this view of science and then go on. One of them is that disagreement is good. Consensus, the beautiful thing about science is that even though we think a lot of ourselves and our point of view individually, we agree to, and we allow ourselves to be forced to come to consensus when we're forced to by the data. Okay? Otherwise, disagreement is great. And here, you know, Harry was saying that, if I can quote you, that you don't read very much because too often you read a book and it changed your life. So those of you who know, Fire Robins Against Method will know that I'm just echoing when he changed my life in that book. He writes that the largest possible disagreement among scientists consistent with the evidence at that time, actually that's, he wouldn't even say that, but I would say that, is good for science. It drives the progress of science forward to have as much competing research programs going on at a time. Therefore, too much agreement before being forced by experiment, premature consensus, is bad for science. Okay. And Fire Robin even says, and I agree, that if there's a research program that has no support or not enough support from experiment, but it's the only one around, you should invent alternatives. And when there are alternatives, Fire Robin says you should support the weakest one. And by the way, there have been some, you know, analogies to economics here, but you know, Eric Weinstein will say, and I don't want to steal his thunder from tomorrow, but will probably say that this is just good investment advice. This is what fund managers do all the time.
One with the least funding or the worst? You probably don't mean the latter. Is the idea just to give people funding to every program?
How these things hash out in detail is fascinating, okay? And how one tries to apply such principles self-consciously, you know, in a position where one is responsible for some hiring like here, you know, there are many issues about it. So you know, there's a lot. Let me just say that I try to follow these, and we, not everybody here, but you know, some of us here try to follow these. So it means, you know, if you're looking at a postdoc pool, okay, and you're in a given field and you get a lot of people working in that field, and then there's somebody from outside of it who has some idea nobody's ever heard of in that field, okay, you, it doesn't mean what you do. It's a complicated decision. But yes, bias against the newest thing. Okay, and the, to me, the most important thing is the last point, which is that to guarantee the continual provocation of novelty, the most efficient thing to do is to make sure that good young scientists have support and have funding based on their own promise and not based on their signing up to work with someone else. So put as much of the support directly into the hands of young people directly, rather than funding the older people to hire them. Okay. And I have a hypothesis, which is that, and I think that this is the kind of thing that there hopefully is and could be serious scholarship about. There are countries where if you hang around, you feel in your bones things like this. In the United Kingdom, one feels more than the United States these kinds of things coming up in discussions. If you talk to people in the academic world there. And if you're from the United Kingdom and you don't think that's true, you haven't spent enough time here. Okay. Holland, you know, the Netherlands is another country, okay, and both where that's true in my limited experience. And both the United Kingdom and the Netherlands contribute way above their investment level. It's a continual mystery why Britain is doing as well as it is in terms of the proportion of important science done there, given the funding and conditions. And I think this is something, these kind of cross national differences are things that could be investigated. The kind of bet that France is willing to make with the CNRS positions of finding a small number of very talented, very promising people, younger than mostly they would get a postdoc in the United States, and give them lifetime permanent positions, is something that you know, goes so far against the grain of how we think about making sure that we're making good investments in North America, but nonetheless reflects a kind of national style which opens up different kinds of alternatives. So I think these things could be investigated. Okay. Now, I have a bit more to say on a general level, and then some I'm clearly not going to get through this whole talk, but I'll get as far as I can. Somebody come back and say, but there are lots of ethical communities. Monasteries are ethical communities. Business clubs, the Alps Club, Chambers of Commerce are ethical communities. What makes science different? And I would say two things constructively, and one thing at the present time. The two things constructively, one of them is what the principles actually are. And the other thing is that embedded in those principles is a characterization that I would call imaginative. That is, the scientific community is built around the idea that we will know more in the future. We're, by definition, expecting to have our minds changed and to have our descendants believe things differently than we believe. And I call such a community that incorporates structures and processes that require that its members change their mind and then invite its members to continually introduce new ideas and new directions, an imaginative community. And I think that that's part of the characterization of science. Another part, which is more accidental, but I think is more and more profound, and you know, this came up in the question you asked in the last talk, you know, about the second peak. Scientific communities used to be national and are increasingly international. They're increasingly a leading example of what Pico Iyer calls a community of global souls. So you are a global soul if you were educated in a different country than you're not working in, or you were born in a different country than you're not working in. Many of us, you know, we're born in one country, educated in a second country, in a third country, working. You're a global soul if your spouse has a different citizenship than you, or if your children have a different citizenship than both you and your spouse, which again is increasingly common. Or if, as Pico Iyer observes himself, you spend more time on airplanes and airports than you spend in your life with your family of origin, you know, parents, aunts, and uncles, and so forth. And the Pico Iyer's conjecture is that a large part of the transformation of the world socially, politically, economically is going to be driven by the fact that more and more people in influential professions, whether it's business, banking, art, theater, science, et cetera, are people who can be characterized this way, and that more and more immigration will become a question not of keeping people out, but of inviting in and retaining people of this characterization. And that's certainly true of Canada, and that certainly, again, is part of the reason why this institute is generously supported by those who support it. So there's a lot more to say about that. But I think that it's hard to avoid that aspect of the scientific community in understanding its present dynamics. Okay, so having set out these characterizations, there are some concerns. And I want to discuss the concerns in there's one in principle, which I'll get to. I'll cut this somewhat short, but I want to put some concerns on the table. And then I want to go to the, in the last 5 minutes, to the issue of science 2.0 in the light of this characterization of science. Globally, let me just put the question on the table, raising the concerns. Most of us do science in universities. We happen not to be in a university here at this moment. As some people have observed, universities evolved out of monasteries, which were institutions which were structured to preserve old knowledge. Are they at all appropriate or the best environments to promote or incubate new knowledge? And if one was going to start over again and invent some institutions and some institutional structures to support science, would one organize them like universities? And that's, I'm not going to address that question. I think we have a session on that tomorrow. But that old global question is beyond the few remarks that I'll make about this. I think there are three issues which I think are important issues for many fields of science now. And And I had the bad judgment to publish something which raised some of these issues. And to me, the most extraordinary thing is the number of communications that I've gotten from people in other fields, some of them, you know, quite high-level, successful people, saying we have exactly the same issues in our field. Okay. And these three issues are promoting the competition between different approaches to a given problem, to a given unsolved problem. Two, which I'll go into in a minute, young versus old scientists. There are issues of power, which sociologists are unashamed to talk about. There are, you know, there's the paradox, which is central to science, that that most important new discoveries and new ideas originate with young people, but most of the power in the governance of the communities and where we live are people 20 to 30 years older. And related to that, the question of finding the right balance between incremental work, which certainly most of science is and should be, and high payoff, high risk, high payoff work. Nobody's interested in high risk, low payoff work, but high risk, high payoff work. Okay. Okay, so let me pick the second one, because I think that because of the demographics that David mentioned, I have a suspicion that the demographics is driving a lot of how we think about the problems we face in the scientific community. And this is a graph recently from a few months ago in the New York Times in an article called The Aging Faculty. Okay. And just look at, in 1969, the percentage of faculty of, these are American universities, under 35, which was something like 35%, and over 50, a bit over 20%. And how much has shifted? Now the proportion of faculty under 35 is 10%, so less than a third less. And the proportion of faculty over 50 has more than doubled to more than half.
Is this a tenure track?
I don't know. I don't know. But it's reference to a study there. Okay. And my sense is that a lot of what we're running up against is this. And as David can tell you, what's happening is this is the cutoff that he talked about right here. And this is the same cohort of people moving through our careers. Okay. And what it means is that there's much more concentration of funding and influence in people who are 20 to 30 to 40 years past their PhD than was true, say, in the great period of the expansion of American post-World War II science. And it means opportunities for younger people are severely limited compared to what they have been. And there are many ways to read this. Here's this is age distribution of principal investigators of NIH, 1991 to 2002. Those under 35 have more than half, from almost 9% to 4%. Those over 55 have almost doubled again. And there, you know, however you cut this up, success rate, what the implications are down here. Success rate for first NIH applications was 86% in 1980, and now it's less than 30%. Okay. What this means is that it's very different to be a young scientist now than it was before 1980. Okay. And my conjecture is that this, to me, explains a lot of the interest in defining new approaches to organize science and collaboration, basically because the ordinary opportunities that used to welcome the good young scientists into the world of academia have been severely restrained and constrained. And in that severe constraints, a lot of bad choices and compromises are necessarily made. And that's a lot of what we worry about. So there's more demographics. Medical school faculty is the same issue. Okay, look at the difference between the age distribution, medical school faculty, and NIH grant holders. Those are these two curves in 1980 as opposed to recently. Okay. There are many ways to cut it up, and they all come to the same conclusion. So I wonder, this is what I just said, whether this isn't a lot of the situation that's driving interest in the topics of this conference, and I also worry very much about the implications for the other issues And here, for example, and I hate reading things directly on the screen, so most of you can read this for yourself. This is a presidential address from the past president of the National Academy of Sciences, Bruce Alford, to the Academy in 2003. Briefly, we have developed an incentive system for young scientists that is much too risk averse. And he goes on to characterize why that is. The damping effect on innovation is enormous because our research universities look for assistant professors who can be assured of grant funding. But the funding agencies, in the light of the demographic pressures that I talk about, that I just talked about, are extremely conservative, especially when it comes to funding young faculty. Is there anything being done about this? In fact, my sense is that the concern for this issue is starting to perk up a lot. Here is a very recent white paper from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences making the same points. Many science and technology funding agencies have become overtly conservative, shying away from high-risk, high-reward research, and thus limiting the prospect of achieving breakthrough results with the potential to transform a field. And they make a series of recommendations which involve especially funding and targeting high-risk, high-payoff researchers, and especially funding and targeting young researchers at the risk of the progress of science. And the list of signatories of this is impressive. It starts with David Baltimore. It includes, forget his name, Lane, who used to be director of the National Science Foundation, Neil Lane, a whole series of the leaders of American science. They've gotten to Senator Obama, who in his answer to something called Science Debates 2008, these are questions posed by scientists, echoes precisely this in his science policy. We will increase research grants for early career researchers to keep young scientists entering science, and we will increase support for high risk, high payoff research portfolios at our science agency. And similarly, there are initiatives in Europe, for example, the European Science Foundation, which is spending billions of euros on new positions motivated by these kind of considerations. So there is concern for these, and I think that they're of serious concern. And hopefully, I mean, in some sense, Perimeter is in part an experiment motivated by these concerns. And it's nice to see the rest of the community waking up to them. Okay, I'm going to skip because I think I have sort of 5 minutes. Okay. So let me talk about science 2.0, the little bit that I understand about science 2.0 in the light of this characterization of science and in the light of these issues, which I think are quite, in my view, are quite severe issues. That the three issues, the imbalance towards incremental, we should always have mostly incremental, but we seem to be out of balance with our high risk, high payoff portfolio. We're squeezing out many young people and lowering opportunities. And you know, what does science 2.0 mean in that context? Well, so there's some obvious things to say, and I won't dwell on them because they've been said here, and they will be said again by people who thought about them a lot more than me. The broadening access and broadening opportunity is important, and it would be nice to know if there's some data about this. The kind of things that people have said about the archives and other such things is that they make it possible to do good science if you're at a small place in India or the Philippines or Montevideo or South Africa. It would be interesting to have some data as to whether that's true. It's both the archive and the whole wealth of blogs and other means that a kid growing up anywhere in the world, as long as they have an internet connection, can have access to the literature and the gossip in the subjects that they're interested in. And as Harry emphasized, science is a verbal culture. So how do you, if you're a kid growing up somewhere, get access into that verbal culture? Okay. Well, the blogs, as much as I've been very frustrated by some aspects of discussion on blogs, the blogs are a way a kid can get access into the verbal culture from almost anywhere. And that's a good thing. And one would like to be able to say something like, we will start to see a generation of kids coming into science energized by this from all parts of the world, and that this is a good thing. Again, it would be nice to have data. Something that was that I heard some discussion about at SciFu, which is another meeting sort of about science 2.0, is this whole issue of sharing data, putting notebooks online, putting your laboratory notes online. And a thing that this certainly does is it weakens the structure by which, you know, the hierarchical structure whereby funds go to senior scientists who then have laboratories or research groups of younger scientists, because younger scientists can communicate laterally with each other by reading each other's data, reading each other's research notebooks. And again, I don't know if there's any, you know, real evidence about this, but this sounds great. Another thing which I think is coming up, I mean, there are many things here to mention, is that one way or the other, it's going to become much more expensive to travel 10 years from now, 20 years from now. We're all going to be doing a lot less traveling. And tools by which we can, as Steve Fuller did, give talks from across the world, by which we can collaborate across the world, are going to become more and more important, because this era of cheap airline tickets is has to end. That's they say. Now, how may, there are also, those are the first easy things to say. There are also some concerns. And here, you know, maybe I'm over-concerned and you can convince me I'm over-concerned. I've hinted at some concerns in what I said before. That is, I am, and I don't want to start right now a discussion about this, but I'm happy to later. I am very concerned about the use of anonymity in scientific discussions online and on blogs. I'm highly concerned. And I think I've explained from a kind of theoretical point of view, from the science demarcation problem, why I'm concerned. But I also have observed that when, you know, those blogs on which anonymous posting is allowed have a very high signal-to-noise ratio and a very high nastiness level, and it's just not consistent with the practice of science. There's low signal-to-noise, thank you. Yeah. We have a well-developed culture of arguing, talking with people we disagree with in person. Okay. And even though I came out of one of the nastiest environments, which was the high energy group at Harvard in the late 70s, okay, which was a very nasty environment, I've the most nastiness I've ever seen in scientific discussions has been online. And I think it gives science a very bad impression to people who are not scientists. And it's, there's no reason to, because it's uncharacteristic of us, because we do know how to deal with and argue with and talk with people we disagree with very politely and friendly.
It's the refereeing system.
There's a lot of things to say about this. Okay. I'm happy to in discussion. I'm in my last 5 minutes, so let me just raise issues. Another thing which here again maybe you can convince me that I'm wrong. I'm concerned about Wikipedia and similar sort of wikiness, because I'm concerned about lack of discipline from lack of authorship. Okay. And maybe you can convince me that a community can discipline itself to root out error without authorship. But, and maybe Wikipedia is the great experiment, but I'm concerned. Okay, so, and I think these things should be discussed. Now, on the positive side, my sense is that there's a whole lot of things that would be nice that, you know, if Moore's Law is really true and things that we dream about now or science fiction writers wrote about 10 years ago, maybe reality in 10 or 20 years, let's dream. What would I really like from the internet, from a totally wired world, to help me be a scientist and my community? The first one is almost trivial and came up. It would be nice to have a better measure of influence than citations. It would be nice to have one that scaled citations appropriately with the size of the community. That was already mentioned, so let me go on. I would love to have a virtual reality representation of the archive. I would love to be able to walk around inside the archive, see the structure, get interested in a paper, you know, blink, see the links of that paper spread out, go pick up a paper and read it right there, okay, through the goggles. I mean, you know, virtual reality was invented as a tool to be a tool for science, and it's not become one. Good point. Good point. Good point. Okay, so I it seems to me that we can dream a lot, and we should. Okay, I'd love to have a visual representation, and I think each of us would, of our own work, in which one could see all the notebooks since high school. Okay, and as somebody who just packed up a lot of stuff and put it in storage, can appreciate that. It's too late for me, but kids now in high school, why shouldn't they start working with something which can be expected to grow and increase in structure till it becomes everybody has access to their life's thought as scientists and as intellectuals? I would love to be able to read a paper in biology or neuroscience and have every specialized term and abbreviation identified, so I would look at this word and blink and the definition would appear. Okay. Because I would love to be able to read specialized papers in fields like biology and neuroscience, and the vocabulary problem now, as Harry says, maybe you just have to hang around and get acculturated, but there's a lot which is just vocabulary, which it seems to me probably we have the software tools to address. I'd love to be able to ask my computer interface would be the best review paper for me to read on star formation, for not for an astronomer, but for somebody with my training and interest, and have it appear. Okay. Now, that's just the beginning. If we have the archive, and we have the various projects going on in other areas, and we have Google, why couldn't we have a representation of the whole scientific literature, going back wherever it goes back to, the Babylonians or Egypt or Africa, the whole thing with links? And I'd like that whole thing in my virtual reality representation. And there were going to be high points. I would love to be able to, on a web page or on my VR interface, go into Einstein's study and pick up books and read them in my language, in my contemporary mathematical notation. And I'd love to be able to do the same with Newton's study and Huygens' bookshelf and so forth. Okay. Social networks are fine, but look, you know, if somebody working on the fundamentals of space and time and gravity and quantum theory, many of the people I'd really most like to talk with are dead. So social networks don't do me any good. Okay. But the same tools could play a role, and this addresses an issue that many people mention. It's so obvious and trivial, it hasn't been mentioned, but there's a way in which the demands on our attention from the interneted world of our field are narrowing our time frame. That as we think in smaller and smaller time units, there was this horizon that Paul showed of, you know, the citation horizon, typically for papers on the archive. It's a few years, okay? What can we do to expand our horizon so that we think about our work in the context of the whole history of science or the whole history of ideas relevant to the question that we're working on? And, you know, there's no better networking tool for ideas than a great library, and why shouldn't all of us have the same access to a great library that Bertrand Russell had when he was a kid? And more generally, you know, could there be ways on the internet to represent the real the real scale of time of the development of science, something like the clock of the long now has been invented to represent the whole flow of civilization in a way that can be very graphic and apparent to us. Why not? I mean, you know, it just happens to be that we archive the papers as they came since 1992, okay? But the same tools can be used to expand our horizon and make us as working scientists as familiar with relevant things using the same techniques of search, not alone semantic search, put us in touch with relevant things from 200 years ago as we are with relevant things coming out of Singapore. And I think that would be a good thing for science. So conclusions, there are many positive things promised in coming out of science 2.0. And some of them can address, not all of them, and they certainly can't solve, but they can address the structural issues I mentioned in the current organization of science. There are also worries of the kind that I mentioned. Anonymity, lack of authorship, narrowing of our time horizons. And I think that these are worries, and we can't let the technology, you know, somebody, this is a long thing, but, you know, in some people's view, a big mistake was made in the way that the internet was invented in such a way as to be so friendly to anonymity. Okay? But we don't have to let that determine how we interact with each other in our communities. Just the fact that email was written in such a way that by people who are libertarians so that anonymity would be easy. That doesn't mean that we have to invite it in. And doing even better than fixing these bugs, and I think they are bugs, in the software we're using, we can imagine inventing great new software tools that will expand our horizons in time, expand our horizons across fields, and I think we should do it. And my conclusion, to come back, is that I argued that there is a solution to the science demarcation problem, which Steve Fuller worried a lot about this morning, and concluded that there was a real problem that science confronted as a result of a lack of solution of it. I think there is a solution of it. I put forward a proposal for one based on these two basic ethical principles that I claim underlie how we interact with each other as members of scientific communities. And my sense is that the new tools and the potential of even more fantastic things are great to the extent to which they reinforce those principles and are worrying to the extent that they're deleterious to them. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
We keep this question session really short because we will have the discussion immediately after this and we will be on the panel anyway.
That'd be a different thing. why don't you?
So you define membership in the community of science as being open to anyone who accepts certain principles and
is willing to train hard to be able to master the techniques current in their field by which they can make convincing cases for evidence.
Right. I know a fair number of people who would strenuously object to that, pointing to very large discrepancies between genders and races in science. So there's, you know, many more men than women in
the
field of
physics. These are very important issues.
I just wonder if you have any comment on that.
Yeah, I think they're very, very serious issues of all kinds. I mean, gender is certainly a very worrying issue, especially in a few areas like physics, where not very many inroads have been made. Race is such a big issue that it's hardly ever even talked about, because there's so few people who challenge us. But you know, to say, and I'm just quoting, I think, Harry in discussing with Steve this morning, said, to say that a community is, so I'm saying something stronger than Harry said, but to say that a community is built around ethical aspirations doesn't mean that they're followed systematically. I mean, there's a belief here, and this is part of a wider discussion. This is part of this is reflecting also, I should say, you know, a lot of influence from social theory, particularly from Roberto Mangibera Unger. This is not utopic, it's not in the category of utopic, that is, it's this or not, it's perfect or it's nothing. This is in a kind of pragmatist tradition of always perfectible. So this is in the you know, tradition of Peirce and Dewey and more recently philosophers like Unger, in which there's no belief in utopia, but there's a belief that there are aspirations that one can always improve their application of.
One of the things you said was that amateurs have no or make no significant contributions.
Maybe I said that too strongly. So, well, but why don't you ask your question?
That's okay. Werner Vinge, in some of his writings, do you know who
No.
He's a computer scientist, mathematician, who writes science fiction models. He's the guy that invented the concept of the technological singularity. That Ray Kurzweil talks about. Well, he talks about the fact that there are large data sets that are coming available publicly and that there are sophisticated tools being made available to the general public, including school children. So he kind of posits in one of his books anyway that there will be a time when they will be able to make significant contributions because they will have sophisticated tools, the knowledge to use, and the availability of the data.
So that's a good case. So I let me tell you what I agree with, and then what I disagree with is probably an essential thing. What I agree with is that it's possible for a gifted young person, it always was possible for a gifted young person with the right opportunities, okay, to become a scientist early. I think that that's true. Nonetheless, becoming a scientist means the same thing. And an analogy is music. That is, you know, if you want to be, there's no way to become a classical music performer without spending many, many years practicing and working on mastering your tradition. Okay? There are some people who've done it well enough by 10 that they're worth hearing. They're very rare. Okay? There are a lot of people who've done it by 20. Okay, as a result of intensive work of the kind that we don't even think of, you know, proposing that children who want to be scientists do. But it doesn't mean that they're not, the fact that you can get well-trained young doesn't mean that you're not well-trained and that you're not educated within the tradition that training represents. So that's the part that I agree with, and I said a PhD or equivalent, I mentioned Freeman Dyson, but there are certainly many other examples. I don't happen to buy any of the vision behind the notion of the singularity technologically. I remain a skeptic about artificial intelligence. I don't think that that mining data is going to replace scientists making hypotheses and doing hard work to dig evidence for those hypotheses out of the data.
Just a quick follow-up on that. One of the things that you bring up in your sort of look to the future about the possibility of science 2.0 is the other use of computers, which is what they choose to actually calculate things, believe when they were originally designed. I mean, the emphasis of the meeting is on mostly on computers as communication devices, which is something that came up late 50s, early 60s. But there seems to be a huge potential for changing certain areas of science via advances in algorithms and hardware. And I think this is probably part of what the other thing. Actually, I'm not sure what the answer is. But it'd be interesting to contemplate, and I don't know if you've thought about this, how, for instance, theoretical physics might be changed if you could solve fairly complicated nonlinear systems on the machine without doing bad approximations. You have a much better handle on various kinds of complex. medical assistant.
I mean, my take on that is that, so I mean, I've written some programs, but I'm not trained computationally. What I do and what most of the people I work with do is methodologically the same thing that Galileo and Huygens and Newton did, not as well. And that's a style and a methodology. There's a tradition behind it. It has a certain power. I have no doubt that computational physics, computation in general, offers a very powerful array of tools. And I admire people who use them well, but that doesn't make the analytic paper and pencil set of tools also important. I mean, new tools are great, just like new experimental techniques are great. We want new, and by the way, nobody's mentioned the LHC turndown today, but it's a very important thing to mention. You know, the foundation of everything is that the disagreements are resolved by experiment, and new methods of experiment are central to the progress of science. Now, there's a way in which one can pose experiments on a computer. When if one is interested in certain kinds of complex systems or phase transitions in certain kinds of many-body systems, one can write new codes and one can do experiments numerically on a computer. And that's a new window, and I think it's a great thing.
I wish I could do it myself,
but it doesn't replace the core, what I think of as the core method behind theoretical physics, which is being able to make a deduction with a pen and paper from principles to experimental conditions.
I'm sure that it doesn't, will never completely replace it, but I think at least it hasn't replaced it, because it's been a very difficult thing to get going, and it's largely a failure, I think, if you look at
it's axiomatic to the view of science I'm presenting is that science is ever modifiable and changeable. And if in 100 years people, the way that most of us do science is building our historical anachronisms, then all the better for science. But that's for the people in 100 years to decide. I don't have much interest in trying to predict how people are going to do science in 100 years. I would predict that if science still exists, it will be because some version of principles like the two I mentioned are animating the interactions amongst the community.
So on the issue of authorship and anonymity, and there's a large body of evidence that Jane Smith has a harder time getting published than John Smith.
Yes.
By introducing some kind of anonymity into the process, you might be able to practically confront sexism and other biases present in academia and actually make a more ethical community. So are the risks really worth?
So reward? Two things to say about this. So first of all, it's the obvious thing, we should address the root problem. If Jane Smith, having a name under which your authorship is known, if that doesn't happen to be the name on your birth certificate, that doesn't matter as long as it's. If Jane Smith wants to be known to the community as J. Smith or John Smith or Jason Smith, that's entirely her problem. Okay. The important thing is that there be a name that contributor is known by. And if a Jane Smith feels that the situation is so bad, and some people do feel it is, that unconscious sexism is really harming careers and doesn't want to be subject to that, then she can choose a pseudonym. There's nothing wrong with choosing a pseudonym, but then she should use it consistently.
I'm not sure.
Oh, I was just going to say about this point about doing theoretical physics with pencil and paper. There's a huge revolution that, to a large extent, has already happened and has been in place for years, which is computer-aided algebra, making analytical calculations of the sort that Lee's talking about of much greater complexity than you would ever dare to embark upon with pencil and paper possible. And I don't know how many papers of mine, and certainly many of the people in this building, have done calculations, analytical calculations, with analytical results, which would not have been possible merely with pen and paper. And I think that is just part of the toolkit. And, you know, like fishes, we don't know about water anymore. So I would just sort of
I agree, counterpoint.
You know, it's the same stuff, but it is actually being done by computer and allows, it expands this range of what one can do by at least an order of magnitude.
And incidentally, you get a digital record
of
what you get, which is one of the things I asked. Yeah, I have a little bit used those tools, and I agree with you completely.
Sherry, I have another question.
I was so impressed and felt so warm about the middle part of your talk where you were talking about the administrative problems of science, that is to say, the tenure situation in the USA, which I've always found horrifying, actually, the number of letters you have to get to write before the age of, written for you before the age of 30. In fact, as far as I can see, coming from Britain, the American academic system is a training in sycophancy from the you know, right up to tenure. You know, you're taught to lick metaphor. And it seems to me that you could do such incredibly good work in pointing this out and trying to stop Britain going down the same route, which it is doing fast. Okay, we're ruining ourselves. But I wish you'd do it. And then I want to say, I wish you wouldn't muddy it by trying to do this ethical stuff at the beginning. See, I completely agree with you. I completely agree with you that the crucial feature of science, the important thing about science in the modern society is to act as an ethical guideline, but it's ever so hard to work out what those ethics could be. Now, as far as I could see, I was going through it, your ethical guidelines, for instance, would allow intelligent designing. I don't think there's anything in your demarcation principle that keeps it out. So I'd start to worry about that straight off. And I think if you were to do that administrative stuff and get it out there fast, it might actually do some work. But if you do the ethical stuff at the beginning of it and you think you need to front it up, you're just going to face endless arguments, and a lot of it's wrong.
So let me not argue. I look forward to arguing with you, you know, over dinner and drinks about the philosophical issues. Okay. You know, ever since I put down Against Method, I wanted to do science more, and I was confused about why, having just read Against Method, I wanted to do science more than before, and I'm still trying to answer that question. There are some straightforward questions that people with your training can answer. Let me mention one. Okay. In the big period of expansion of post-war science, both in the United States, Canada, and Europe, it was not difficult to get an academic position. Many people went straight from a PhD to an assistant professorship in some university somewhere without applying for any position. Somebody made a phone call to their advisor and talked to them. Okay. So there was a large period in which, to become a professor at an elite Ivy League university, there was a lot of competition and a lot of issue. But to become a professor somewhere, you know, at the University of Ohio or Michigan or something like that, for a long time, there was virtually no selection apart from getting a PhD. Since 1980, we've had a very narrow selection that we spend endless hours trying to get right. The burden of you know, people your age, my age, okay, the burden on us of trying to make this system work is enormous. Okay. I would be very interested if there was any sensible way in which the question could be asked. Okay, was the progress of science as healthy and as fast in a period when there was very little selection beyond a PhD compared to how it's been since there's been a very narrow selection that takes us a lot of our professional time? And that's not an answerable question, but maybe there's a version of an answerable question.
Well, you answered it in your talk, because you pointed out the high rate of success of UK academics for a small number of dollars. And there's virtually, up to for a long period, there's virtually no selection in Britain. Anybody walks in and gets tenure.
Okay. No, but
it works.
Yeah, but me and you having this conversation is not something that I can, you know, that we can take to NSERC for the National Science Foundation or NIH. Okay. But I can imagine a study being done by people in your profession, okay, that you could take You know, and you know, the people at, I don't know about the other agencies, the people at NSF understand this stuff. They would like too to get out from under this. They would like to get back to the era where there were a few program managers who had virtual carte blanche to fund who they thought was worth funding, however much they thought was worth funding them. Maybe they sent them out for review, but they could then do exactly what they want and use their judgment. And the program offices at the NSF now that I speak with would love to get back to that era and not be bound by these piles of bureaucracy and numerical measurements. But they, you know, they would need evidence to make a case to their direct, you know, to their directors to go back to the older way of working.
So this is mainly comments, so it won't take sure. us any further. It may be hopeless because we discussed Bernard Vinge at lunch, and you have no recollection of it 4 hours later.
You're right.
So, first, there's a comment you mentioned, the historical timeline, and that's one where we can say there is rapid progress ongoing at the NIH, at the NLM. They're busily backscanning as much of the biological literature as they can get, putting it online in PubMed Central, making it as interoperable with the ongoing literature as they can. Even in physics, we have this, the American Physical Society, wonderfully backscanned everything, recreated the front and back matter, put it together, and a very nice set of resources. And when you look at the data, it's wonderful when you see heavy usage of articles like the original EPR article. Now, speaking of nastiness, I have to lecture you and disabuse you of some confusion you've apparently carried through your entire career, which is Harvard was not a nasty place when you were there. I was there too. And you know, if you went back knowing what you know now, you would realize that you were just too thin-skinned. So my thoughts are helpful. Speaking of nastiness, this is not a question. Okay, so finally, speaking of nastiness, at the risk of seeming just as fossilized as you, I actually completely agree with you on the question of anonymity. It's entirely perplexing to me. I've seen this argument from up and down and seen people asserting otherwise. And there's this simple reductio ad absurdum, which might be completely irrelevant as far as any of these people are concerned. But suppose we were here in this auditorium, but instead it was being staged in some Fellini movie, and we had groups of dwarves dressed in clown suits trying to pull you down, groups of children screaming, people throwing food at us. And they're all wearing masks. You have no idea what they are. That's what having a blog discussion with anonymity is like. So we should close here and move on to the discussion.